Hello and welcome to this information podcast on behalf of the Bath Institute for Rheumatic Diseases. My name is Mel Brook and I'm the Patient and Public Engagement Programme Director for BIRD. This podcast episode is about the new British Society for Rheumatology Psoriatic Arthritis Guidelines. And my guest is Dr. William Tillett, a consultant from the Royal National Hospital for Rheumatic Diseases in Bath. The BSR guidelines are our framework for the treatment and management of psoriatic disease. And Dr. Tillett is going to walk us through the background and the content of these new guidelines. Hello, Will. Thanks for joining us on this podcast today.
Hi, Mel. Thanks for the invitation to come and talk about the psoriatic arthritis guidelines.
Always good to have you on the show. So just for people who haven't met you before or listened to you before, could you just give us a little bit of background about you, who you are and where you work and what you do?
Yes, absolutely. So my name's William Tillett. I'm a consultant rheumatologist at the Royal National Hospital for Rheumatic Diseases in Bath. That's now part of the Royal United Hospital. And I specialise in psoriatic arthritis. We treat a wide range of people as well as conduct research to try and improve the lives of people living with psoriatic arthritis by better understanding the condition and the medicines that are available.
Fantastic. And I think we probably, if we can, just give a little bit of a recap about what we know about psoriatic arthritis.
Sure. So we know that about 2% of the UK population live with psoriasis, which is a rash that frequently affects areas of the body, such as the elbows and knees, but it can affect the hairline and pretty much anywhere else. But one in five people with psoriasis will also get arthritis, which is a long-term inflammatory arthritis that affects the joints, the tendons, sometimes the spine, and this causes swelling, pain and stiffness. And obviously you can imagine that causes a big impact on people's lives, limiting what they can do and how they feel. And fortunately, in recent years, there's been a rapid expansion of the medicines that can available for the treatment of that condition, and they can be highly effective.
Yeah. And we've got a whole series, haven't we, of podcasts about psoriatic arthritis and the medications that people can go and listen to if they want to get more information.
Sure, absolutely. So my colleague Ellie Korandovich has done a great podcast on understanding psoriatic arthritis. And I think you and I have done a podcast looking at medicines that are available.
Yeah, we have. So today we're going to be talking about some guidelines that have come out for the treatment of psoriatic arthritis. So again, this is a really important topic that we felt we wanted to share with people to let them understand what it is, what it means, why it's important. This is all around what we call shared decision making, isn't it? I think it's important to mention that as well.
Absolutely. So when people come to visit their rheumatology team in hospital, it's our sort of hope and expectation that we can have a conversation about what medicines and other treatments are available for people. And then we can try and find the thing that best suits that person at that particular time. And so, as you rightly say, this concept of shared decision making, where both people are actively contributing to try and find the best option that's available.
Indeed. So we'll start off with the British Society for Rheumatology and I'll maybe give a little bit of background about who they are.
Sure. So the British Society for Rheumatology is the UK's leading specialist medical society for the treatment of rheumatic conditions, which include psoriatic arthritis. And amongst the many things that the BSR does, it produces guidelines. Now, these guidelines, Mel, are targeted at healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. So they're medically written, and they try and offer pragmatic guidance to help people who may not treat psoriatic arthritis very often or may have a good knowledge about it, but may struggle to keep up to date with absolutely all of the cutting edge knowledge. So those guidelines are updated and published for freely available for anyone to read. They're really helpful for the wider clinical team to try and get the right treatment to the right person at the right time.
So this is a kind of a template. So are there differences between people being treated in a specialist centre or...
Well, that's exactly what the guidelines are there for. They are a concise summary of best practice for the treatment of people living with psoriatic arthritis. And it means that wherever you're being treated, whether it's locally or in a specialist centre, you should have a standard of care. And one of the things that we do with the guidelines, and I know we'll get into the nitty gritty in a little bit, is that we have an audit tool there which helps units examine their current practice and compare them to the current guidelines. And if there are little gaps there, then they can make those changes that are needed so that they are matching their practice to the up-to-date guidelines.
Are these UK specific as well? They're not shared across European organisations?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. They are first and foremost for UK rheumatology teams. But the British Society of Rheumatology guidelines are really well regarded internationally. Mm-hmm. And they are adopted by many rationed healthcare settings. You'll appreciate that there's different levels of access in different countries to different medications. So the BSR guidelines wouldn't necessarily be applicable to all healthcare settings, but many, particularly European countries, look at them with interest. And the advantage of being UK specific is that we can be a little bit more detailed in the advice we give. Mm. There's other guidelines that are available, and you know, listeners may have heard of GRAPPA, the Group for Research and Assessment of Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis, or EULAR, which is the European Rheumatology Association. They tend to offer excellent advice, but it may not be quite as specific because they're trying to be applicable across healthcare settings in numerous different countries. Whereas with the British Society of Rheumatology guidelines, we can offer really specific advice to our current and rationed healthcare system, but it's really useful internationally as well.
Mm, well, it's good to know. So the last set of these guidelines, as I understand it, were published in 2012, is that right?
That's right. There's been a longer gap than I think we would have ideally liked between the last guidelines in 2012 and the current version, which were released towards the end of 2022. And in fact, there'd been such a gap between the two guidelines, we had to change the name. The original guidelines were called the anti-TNF guidelines. But since those guidelines were released, we've had a rapid expansion of the number of different medicines and therapeutic options that are available. We've had much better understanding of related conditions that many people with psoriatic arthritis live with and which medicines are effective for those conditions. We've had some really important studies on how we should use existing drugs, and all of those three areas have been combined together in the updated biologic guidelines to try and guide clinicians on which medicines are best used in which setting.
So there's really good time to update everything then as well needed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a massive change in what we've been able to revise.
So we've talked about the BSR, or the British Society of Rheumatology, being involved in writing these guidelines. Were NICE involved? We hear about NICE. I think it's probably good to mention who they are.
So that's right. The NICE, or the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, are an organisation that, amongst other things, produces guidance. And these are evidence-based recommendations developed by independent committees, including professionals, lay members, and other key stakeholders. But one of the key roles of NICE is to offer guidance in what is a rationed healthcare setting. So something that the British Society of Rheumatology have done is work closely with NICE to make sure that any guidance offered by the BSR is approved by NICE. And that's the case with our updated psoriatic arthritis biologic guidelines. They are approved by NICE. And that means that we've followed a very stringent process. We've undertaken a really detailed systematic literature review, and that means that we've gone to all of the literature that's been published around our recommendations over the last decade since the last guidelines were released, to make sure we've got all of the information at our fingertips to offer to guide our recommendations.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're talking about the process for writing the guidelines and looking back through all the evidence. Everything's got to be evidenced to be able to be in the new guidelines.
That's right. I think just to be clear that NICE offer advice on the effectiveness and cost effectiveness of medications. And whilst the British Society of Rheumatology guidelines are registered with NICE, we've considered cost in advice, but it's not, you know, it's not been the driving factor in the guidance available. We've really focused on the evidence around the effectiveness of medications, where the data lies. We've involved, I'm sure we'll get into this, other key stakeholders when we've been making recommendations. We've had really important patient involvement. We've had guidance from multiple medical specialties as well as the BSR.
So we've talked about the old guidelines and the fact that they were called the anti-TNF guidelines. And now we're going to move on and talk about the new 2022 guidelines. What's really different? What's been done that's different this time?
Well, I get lots is the same. So we've underpinned the guideline with a systematic literature review. So we've looked at all of the evidence that's available. We've looked at all of the drugs are now used for the treatment of psoriatic arthritis. We've involved key stakeholders in doing the guidelines. So that means that it wasn't just rheumatologists, it was dermatologists who specialise in psoriasis, ophthalmology, gastroenterology. So these are specialties that look after eye and gut conditions, which are frequently seen in psoriatic arthritis. We've had a general practitioner, we've had nurse specialists, patient representatives. So all of that's the same sort of process as we had before. That rigor of development is still there.
Mm.
But the guidelines look profoundly different. And that's because we've got all of these different drugs that we've been able to offer guidance on. And we've summarized those in a treatment algorithm that really follows the journey of the condition from diagnosis through to early treatment, how we should be treating effectively. And that's using a treat to target approach, which we can get into in a bit more detail, or some of the listeners may have heard about. And then a focus on those advanced therapies, those biologic and targeted synthetic drugs, how they should be used and in which clinical setting.
Mm. So there's a lot more into it. So is it a kind of, if I was trying to picture this in a visual way so that people could understand it, is it like almost a flow chart of from the very beginning of somebody's PSA journey through to the treatment that's potentially most appropriate for them?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. We haven't specifically covered the literature on early diagnosis, on conventional treatments, physiotherapy, diet and arthritis, all of those other things that we know to be so important for people living with psoriatic arthritis. So this is very much a guideline that's targeted around those advanced therapies. But you're right. If you're wanting to imagine how the guideline looks, we've started with the assessment of disease and all of those aspects of the condition that people live with. We've then offered specific advice on what medicines you should offer in the early stages, and then how you should select and modify those biologic and targeted synthetic drugs if the initial steps haven't worked. So it's a flow chart through the condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also got what we've called practice points. And I think these are really great additions to the guidelines. We've said if somebody has, you know, one associated condition, let's say uveitis, which is when the eye can become inflamed. We had our ophthalmologist guiding us on how that should affect our treatment decisions. We've got practice points around people who have poor response to initial therapies and what you should do in that setting. We've also considered other aspects of psoriatic arthritis, such as cardiovascular risk, that's the risk of heart attacks or strokes in people living with inflammatory conditions, and how we can try and reduce the chance of that happening. So it's a flow chart through treatment stages with these practice points to help guide clinicians. And actually, we've summarized this into a single flow chart available for clinicians, but there is a lengthy document if the clinical team needs to get into the nitty-gritty of why we've made decisions, which is often needed. You know, often you can't get everything into a single flowchart.
Mm.
But this flowchart is for medical professionals, and it's not designed for patients necessarily. So some of the terminology is scientific and it may not be easily accessible.
Yeah, it does make sense to think that this is a step towards finding the right treatment for the right person, is it personalized medicine, and you're taking into consideration all of the things that affect them, all of the extra symptoms and maybe the what we call comorbidity, so other conditions. It does make sense that it's that's the future, isn't it?
That's right. We've gone as far as we can with this. We've got evidence-based guidelines. Mm. That's what these are. But we have the BSR allow you to make what are called eminence-based recommendations. And these are when there isn't evidence. There's not a research study to answer the particular problem. Mm. But so-called experts can say what they are currently doing based on their knowledge and experience. And so where we said the evidence is lacking, the recommendation are weaker. But we know that these are decisions that are clinicians and people living with psoriatic arthritis are having to make every day in clinical practice all around the country. We've offered recommendations in that setting too. We haven't managed to go the full personalized medicine step up because it just doesn't exist for us at the moment. Mm. And there's lots of exciting research happening at the moment to try and have a blood test that will predict whether or not medicines work. That would be precision medicine at a new level.
Yeah.
But we've gone as far as we can with the data we have for now.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, really, when you think about the difference between the 2012 guidelines and the 2022 guidelines. In the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, I wonder what will have changed by the time the next guidelines come out, you know, because this is quite a leap. So it's quite inspiring to think that in, you know, 10 years or whatever's time, there will have been an equal large leap towards that again.
I think there will be. I think I'm sure we'll have some new blood tests that are able to improve the selection of treatment. We'll have more head-to-head trials. That means that individual medicines will be directly compared to others in a randomized controlled trial, because there's surprisingly few of those in the world of psoriatic arthritis, partly because they're hugely expensive to run. There'll be more treatment strategy trials, and there are some running at the moment. So these are studies where we compare the ways in which medicines are used. So a great example for that might be, should you give somebody a biologic drug at their diagnosis, or should you give them conventional medicines, and if they don't work, give them a biologic? So that would, you'd be randomized to one of those two treatment options, and the trial would tell you which one of those was best on a group level. So we're going to have more treatment strategy trials that are going to come out over the course of the next few years, and they're the type of thing that really change these guidelines.
And more evidence, isn't it? It's more evidence towards the things that are effective. We could talk about that for ages, I think, the whole research cycle, and it does take a long time. So it sounds slow, but I think really it's the blink of an eye when you think about how things move on.
It can feel slow, particularly for people living with the condition currently.
You know, yeah, it can.
What should I be doing? And it's hard for doctors to keep up with everything that's going on. But if you're actually living with the condition, it can seem really, really slow.
Yeah, I know. So in the new guidelines, Will, what are what we would call the overarching principles?
So many guidelines take this approach where they say, right, these are our themes, these are our overarching recommendations that should apply to everyone. And we've taken the same approach. So our first recommendation is that decisions should be individualized and based on shared decision making. And we've already discussed that a little bit today, haven't we? And that makes a lot of sense. We felt that was really important. Mm-hmm. We have recommended that you should assess all aspects of the disease to help make a treatment decision, which sounds really obvious, but I think is something that really influences which medicine is right for you. We have said that when people don't respond brilliantly well to medications, which unfortunately still happens, that you should go back and confirm the diagnosis, check that there could be symptoms coming from other causes, and whether or not people are persisting with their medication, because often if something is not felt to work quickly, people will stop taking the medicine, which is very understandable. But often doctors don't think of that. And then finally, we have recommended that if all treatment options are equally suitable for somebody, to choose the most cost effective in that setting. So that sounds like rationing, but actually there are instances where there are lots of different drugs that would be equally suitable for an individual. In that case, it makes a lot of sense to choose the one that's most cost effective.
And the guidelines talk about domains a lot, which to describe in a lay way is.
So that's the area of your body that's effective. And this is important because the medicines have different levels of effectiveness on different bits of the body. All right. The one domain would be the arthritis. So arthritis affecting the joints that you can see, such as your wrists or your elbows or your shoulders. And in these guidelines, we've recommended which medicines to use if people are primarily affected by arthritis of these type of joints that I've just described, because some drugs are more effective in that setting than others. We have lots of experience with anti-TNF drugs, and they're very good in that setting. So are the IL-17 drugs, and so are the JAK inhibitor tablets. These are targeted synthetic medications. So whilst we've singled out those particular drugs to be highly effective for arthritis, it's worth saying that other groups of drugs are licensed for use in psoriatic arthritis and are very effective. And those would be the IL-23 drugs, IL-12/23 drugs, PDE4 drugs. And I'm conscious that I'm giving you an alphabet soup here, but these are the groups of drugs that are effective. And what we've said is these are the top drugs for effectiveness for arthritis, whilst all of them are good and effective for people living with peripheral arthritis.
And so the really good thing about having these recommendations in the guidelines is that this is going to clarify that for all kinds of healthcare providers, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
Physicians,
Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely right. Absolutely right. And it recognizes that some drugs are a little bit more effective than others. That said, all of the drugs we have included in these guidelines are approved and licensed for use in the management of psoriatic arthritis. And so you can have confidence that all of these drugs could be effective for you. We've just said that some are potentially more potent than others. And that really helps clinicians around the country choose which order drugs to give you. But thinking about those domains, another domain of disease might be the spine. And it turns out that some drugs are better than others for treating the spine. And I mentioned anti-TNF, that works brilliantly for the spine. So does IL-17. And it turns out the JAK inhibitor class work for the spine. But at the moment, our understanding is that drugs like IL-23 drugs, they don't work for spinal inflammation. So if that's a big part of your condition, you might prefer to choose anti-TNF, IL-17, or potentially JAK inhibitors.
So all these drugs are out there, but all of them have benefits potentially in different areas, and that's what the guideline is helping people decide on, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the sands can shift, can't they? People can have bad arthritis at one point in their condition, or really bad psoriasis at one point in their condition, and then some medicines will help one part of that, but maybe not all. And then when you have to make another decision, you've got to weigh up how bad the condition has been in the past, how it's currently affected you, and then these guidelines can help the clinician offer you the right options.
Yeah, it's a big decision and it's complicated, so it's good to have that all streamlined.
Yeah, I think that's right. We've also gone on to talk about how drugs should be used. And so another consideration apart from these domains that we've discussed is how you should treat drugs. This would be treatment strategy. And one of the recommendations we've made is that people should be offered a treat to target approach. That means that you should have your arthritis measured. You should decide with your doctor how deeply you want your arthritis in remission. And some people want more drugs and have the lowest level of arthritic control as possible. And some people might want less medicines and accept a slightly higher level of disease activity. But you reach that, you establish that target with your doctor or healthcare provider, and then you have your medications changed until you reach that target. So it's not recommending specific drugs, but it's recommending that you have your condition measured and you escalate until you've reached the target that you and your doctor have agreed on. And it turns out, although that sounds so desperately simple, it's a highly effective way of treating people. And we know that if you have a treat-to-target approach to your condition, you're likely to have less pain, better quality of life, less damage to your joints. And it doesn't recommend a specific drug. It just recommends the way in which drugs should be used for you. And that's something that we've recommended in the guidelines. It's not necessarily for everyone, and some people don't want to have such intensive treatment, but we've said it should be offered to everyone.
Do the guidelines mention anything about the kinds of things that people can do themselves? Is that anything that comes into it, lifestyle or?
Yeah, absolutely. We've recognised the importance of that. We know that there is data showing that, for instance, if people are overweight or even obese, that weight loss can be effective in terms of reducing psoriatic arthritis activity. So we've offered advice on weight loss and signposting to the relevant services that are local to you in the UK. We have recommended that smoking cessation advice needs to be given. That we know that that can impact how active the condition is and your likelihood of responding to treatment. We have specified that people's weight and smoking status shouldn't influence treatment decision itself. So those lifestyle choices shouldn't impact the medicines you're offered. But we have said that they are things that people can do to improve not only their condition, but also their long-term health.
And these things are, again, evidenced through some research that's been done.
That's right. We've been able to offer different levels of strength of support for each of these recommendations. So, for instance, when it comes to weight loss, we've said that that was a grade 1A recommendation. So that's top tier. There's a good study showing that that was effective. And then when we vote on that evidence as a group, we can give a strength of agreement, and that the weight loss had a 98% strength of agreement. We had smoking cessation advice was grade 1A and strength of agreement of 99%. So really strong recommendation there.
That's interesting. So within the guidelines, is there anything written for mentioning when people are in remission? Does anything change?
Absolutely. So we think that's an important step in in people's treatment. Once people have achieved a state of sustained remission, it's important to begin to stop or taper and stop medicines. We've recommended tapering drugs that might cause negative health effects, such as anti-inflammatory medications. We've then offered advice on when people should have tablets alongside their biologics. And so we've said that, for instance, those conventional DMARD, disease-modifying drugs shouldn't be routinely required. Sometimes people might need them, but if you're in a state of remission, you could taper and stop those. And then for people who are in really sustained remission, we've recommended that you can have a conversation around tapering therapy. And that means increasing the gap between your biologic injections, so giving you the least amount of drug that keeps you well. There's less evidence in this area, but we recognize that people are doing it all around the UK and that people can do really well. And that for the vast majority of cases, if when you begin to taper your medicine, you do experience a worsening of your condition that's not, that doesn't settle with standard flare control, then you can go back up to the dose at which you last felt well. But as a principle, most people want to be on the least amount
At
of
least.
that keeps them well. But I would urge you to do that, in consultation with your clinical team. It's not something to take on yourself. You want to make sure all those safety nets are there for you and that it's right for you.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a conversation you could have, isn't it? If you felt that way inclined, or you feel, I've reached a point where actually I feel really good. Could I maybe take slightly less medication now? Perhaps you've hit the disease enough to keep it at bay. But I think it's a conversation that people could just open up with
I
their.
think that's exactly right. But do it in consultation. There are lots of advantages to this. And I think if you've got to think more broadly, there's advantages to you as an individual. If it's right for you, and if the elements of your condition mean that this is suitable for you, then that's great for you personally, but also for the healthcare setting, itself. We're in a rationed healthcare system, and I think there's a pressure on providers and users to use that limited resource responsibly. And it could potentially save the NHS lots of money by using less medicine, particularly if it's not needed. But of course, I think the the first and foremost consideration is if it's right for you. And
Mm.
it would, you know, there are instances where it wouldn't be the right thing to do. Let's say if you've had really bad arthritis that's been really difficult to control, and you've tried lots of different medicines, and you know, you're on the sort of last drug that's available. I wouldn't be recommending you make big changes there, because the risks or the ramifications of flare would be too great. You know, you might want to factor in whether or not, you know, you've got lots of damage to your joints, because once that occurs, it's not possible to repair. So a lot of the use of these drugs is sort of around preventing damage. So yeah, it's not something to do on your own bat, but it is something to consider if you've been doing really well for a good length of time and you're off all of your other medicines.
Just sounds like it allows for some flexibility, and it's not like you go on a medication and that's it. There are choices. For some people, it might be that that's it, but for others, it might be that they can change it along the way, and that's quite empowering, I think.
I agree. I think it's important to have that sense of control of your medicines.
So, well, we've mentioned that these guidelines are essentially really for healthcare providers and clinicians. So they might be a bit complicated for patients to understand. Are there versions out there that are a bit more kind of patient-friendly, lay summaries?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously we've got all of the Bird material on the Bird website, which is, I think, a great starting point. If you want to get more into medical guidelines, but from a sort of a patient perspective, the Group for Research and Assessment of Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis, GRAPPA, have a patient summary of the GRAPPA treatment guidelines, and that was developed with people living with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis who are intimately involved. So it's much more accessible, I think, from a patient perspective. So the GRAPPA patient treatment guidelines are available to you. There is something called the Informatory, which is a resource designed for people living with psoriatic arthritis, developed by people living with psoriatic arthritis, and it includes medication, but it also includes how to manage other aspects of your condition. There's the Psoriasis Association, which provides some really good material available for you. And there's the Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis Association, so PAPA, and they have a rich history of providing educational material around treatment options, as well as understanding the condition yourself. And listen, I've just mentioned a few there. I'm sure you can put the links for those at the foot of this podcast. I think that, you know, it's really empowering to learn about the treatment options that are available to you, but it can get a bit overwhelming. So, you know, I'd say dip your toe in the water with the Bird podcasts, and if there are things that you want to focus more on, then some of those websites might help you. We probably should mention Versus Arthritis as well. So Versus Arthritis have got a long history of providing educational material both for healthcare professionals and people living with all sorts of rheumatic complaints. So I think that list would be incomplete without mentioning them as well.
Absolutely. And we'll pop a few of those links in our show notes, and then that'll just be a starting point for people if they want to try and find more information.
Sure.
Brilliant. Thanks, Will. Thanks ever so much for joining us today. Well, that's a lot of information for people to take on board, but obviously the good thing about podcasts is they can sort of dip in, dip out, come back and listen again. But really appreciate that you've done your best to explain about the new BSR guidelines.
Thank you, Mel. Look, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. We've been really excited about the development of them, and we really hope that they'll improve care for people living with PSA all around the UK for a number of years to come.
Brilliant. Thanks for sharing. Thanks to you, Dr. Tillett, for joining us today on this podcast. There's a lot of information, so please remember you can listen again and again as many times as you need to. We hope that the information given in this podcast goes some way to helping you to feel better informed and make shared decisions with your clinicians. Bird are committed to helping patients increase knowledge about rheumatic conditions because we know this can have a really positive impact on living with them. We also have a great focus on enabling people to get involved in rheumatology research to help make sure that new medications and treatments meet the needs of patients. We couldn't do any of this without the help of our volunteers and the support of our donors and sponsors, all of whom we are immensely grateful to. You can sign up to be notified about all our podcasts and our patient engagement research opportunities by joining our mailing list. Just send an email to admin@birdbath.org.uk. The address and links are in the show notes.